two pandemics that are happening. That fast pandemic being coronavirus, that slow pandemic being systemic racism.
We've talked about how there is a disparity in the numbers when it comes to race and COVID-19.
Last year, pretty early on in the pandemic, it became clear that across the country, Black people were getting sick and dying at rates far above white people.
Aren't we also a high-risk group as African Americans? I mean, 52%, there are more African Americans dying than healthcare providers.
This is a force that has long marked Black people as killable, as disposable, as having bodies and having lives that aren't to be valued in the same ways as other people.
Maybe the virus itself doesn't see color, but the health system has always discriminated against the Black community, and the effects were devastating.
I am the disproportionate burden that coronavirus has impacted the Black and brown community. That is me. That's my family.
If you look at where Black women have been throughout history, you have to have the idea that, you know, someone's got to do it.
We always will have to fight for us. No one else will fight for us. We all we got.
From the moment the pandemic started over a year ago, it's been Black women who have jumped in and cared for their communities. I'm Annette John Hall, host of WHYY's Real Black History, a year-long series that looks at the contributions of African Americans in our community. For Women's History Month, we honor the Black women who have battled against two daunting forces, the pandemic and systemic racism.
I understand that you need to test the healthcare providers, you need to test the elderly, but aren't we also a high-risk group as African Americans? I mean, 52%, there are more African Americans dying than healthcare providers, right, in terms of percentage. So, but I'm turning that anger, that frustration into action.
Ayla Stanford, a surgeon and founder of Real Concierge Medicine, saw the need and, as she's done all of her life, jumped right in. Last April, when confusion about testing was rampant, she organized testing that the Black community could access and named the operation the Black Doctors COVID-19 Consortium.
It makes me angry to see the lack of attention, the lack of importance putting on these African American lives. The fact that I feel like I have to fight so hard to get basic equipment and testing.
With logistical help from her pastor, Reverend Marshall Mitchell of Salem Baptist Church in Abington, Stanford rented a van, filled it with medical supplies, and she and a couple of volunteers started testing in Black church parking lots across the city. It was a struggle. She had to bust through barriers every step of the way.
And I don't want to wear a trash bag out here, but I am running out of supplies desperately. And I appreciate the donations, but we need the equipment, the protective equipment, so we can keep working, so we can keep providing this service.
Stanford's held nationally as a champion against the pandemic. She's quick to tell you she couldn't do it alone.
The one thing I don't have to fight for is to get people here to help.
Stanford has always been able to rely on other Black women. When she first put out the call for volunteers, they answered, and they've been with her ever since. For new healthcare professionals like Dr. Natalie Gonzalez, volunteering served as an on-the-job training of sorts. Gonzalez is a pediatrician at Einstein Medical Center now. But she was fresh out of medical school and poised to begin her career when the pandemic hit.
To be sitting at home during a pandemic and have all this knowledge base, but not enough of the ability to do something, because quote unquote, technically I'm not a doctor at that point in time. I felt like being at the BDCC gave me the opportunity to utilize my brain power and my skill set.
Never mind that Gonzalez had no experience. Stanford assigned her to be director of operations during those early days of COVID testing. To have the faith of someone like Stanford, who Gonzalez considered a role model, meant the world to her.
I felt like it helped me grow as a person, It helped me grow as a future physician and now an actual physician. And then it helped fulfill this sense of wanting to be a part of the pandemic in a positive manner because I knew that our community needed help.
Black and brown Philadelphians were contracting the disease in alarming numbers. As Sheila McMillan watched the slow horror of the pandemic unfold on television, she felt the same way as Dr. Gonzalez, that something had to be done. And when she saw this thing called the Black Doctors COVID-19 Consortium, and that Dr. Stanford was running it, well, the Philadelphia emergency room nurse jumped at the chance to volunteer because her connection to Dr. Stanford is personal.
I've known Dr. Stanford for about 15 years now. She did surgery on my daughter, who at the time was 3 months old.
Dr. Stanford removed a cyst from McMillan's daughter's liver, a complicated surgery on an infant.
And I hand her over and I said, I'm trusting you with my life. She says, I'll guard it. And I said, okay. And what was supposed to be a 3-hour surgery was 6.
As nerve-wracking as the experience was, McMillan took comfort in knowing that a Black female surgeon, a rarity, was in charge of her daughter's care.
She checked in. She was very caring, very compassionate, great bedside manner, amazing bedside manner. If she was unsure about something, we worked through it together. She would research it for me and come back to me. So she calmed a lot of my fears.
McMillan says the lack of Black providers is a big reason why African Americans hesitate to get the care they need. So she knew there was a good chance that a lot of Black folks would appreciate getting tested by Black medical professionals. What she wasn't prepared for were the thousands who showed up.
I was extremely surprised to see everyone wanted to get tested. But I mean, you have these people that are dropping dead. You know, people were scared. People go into the hospital, they don't come out.
But when it came to the vaccinations, more people were hesitant. So McMillan tried to reassure people during the few minutes she spent interacting with them. She remembers an incident at a recent event. A woman called to say that her mother had just died of COVID. But still, despite her grief, the woman wanted to get vaccinated that day.
You know, Dr. Stanford said, come. Put it in front of the line, no matter what time it is. She came, and I happened to be standing next to her when she came. And we sat, we shut the line down, and we prayed for her. And with her.
This is Real Black History. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Annette John Hall. This is Real Black History. We all remember the days when the president tried to convince us that the pandemic wasn't that big a deal.
This is going to go away without a vaccine. It's going to go away, and we're not going to see it again, hopefully, after a period of time.
BDCC volunteer Sydney Walker made a point to educate the public about COVID from the very beginning.
Constantly trying to fight conspiracy theories, fight what the government is saying, and then also teach about why this virus is so dangerous was what I really had to focus on when speaking with people. You had to figure out a creative, sensible way of explaining how viruses work and why people are dying from this and why it's more than just a simple flu.
Walker says it's a myth that Black people don't want the vaccine. Once they're armed with proper information, they want to be vaccinated just like anyone else who's trying to protect their health.
In media, all you heard, the rhetoric was, oh, Black people don't trust the vaccine, Black people don't do this. But once you see a group of Black health professionals that are actually coming forth with the education and, with the proper information to help inform the community, and then people are more open to, listening and trusting.
Walker's a newly minted nurse. Her first professional experience was volunteering for the BDCC. She says the work has been nonstop, but the gratitude that people have showed gives her the energy to keep going.
They call you a hero when you're sitting there. And I'm thinking to myself, I am no hero. and it's because I never thought of, you know, what I'm doing as heroic work.
Caring for folks is in Walker's bloodline. Her grandmother worked as a nurse in Virginia for 40 years.
She always told me about the joy that taking care of people brought her. And I said, well, Grandma, like, you're always around people with these really serious diseases that are really contagious. Like, you're not scared? She goes, well, somebody's got to do it. If you look at where Black women have been throughout history, you have to have the idea that, you know, someone's got to do it.
Walker graduated from an HBCU, so she knows the importance of being taught and nurtured by somebody who looks like you. She tries to give people that same affirming experience with the BDCC.
All those interactions has just really taught me a lot about the importance of, one, having a person of color speaking to someone who is of similar racial background or ethnic background, and the importance of that and how it helps with education and how it helps with retaining information and helps with connecting with the patients.
History teaches us that medical systems have been rife with racial biases that cause them to cater to white patients and give Black patients good reason to distrust them. As a Black physician, Dr. Chris Purnell understands the mistrust and confusion that many African Americans bring into their interactions with health systems, and why it's crucial for trusted medical workers to provide that information. It's one of the reasons she became a public health physician in the first place.
I see public health really as my calling.
Purnell doesn't see patients in a clinical setting. Her mission is all about preventative care.
I like to tell people I treat systems, right? Systems of care, systems in the public.
Black patients, more than white patients, suffer from conditions like poverty, toxic environments, trauma, and racism, a disease Purnell describes as a pre-existing condition.
There are actually two pandemics that are happening, a fast pandemic and a slow pandemic. That fast pandemic being coronavirus, and that slow pandemic being systemic racism that has been harbored in the soil of this nation even before its founding.
The doctor works at University Hospital, a partner with Rutgers Medical School in Newark. Last year, the school sponsored a clinical trial for a COVID vaccine. Purnell wondered, what if she volunteered for the trial? Could the Black community benefit? Her answer was yes. She knew of the disturbing history regarding African Americans in healthcare in this country. She knew about enslaved Black women who were forced to undergo sterilization without anesthesia or consent. Black cemeteries being robbed of bodies for study. She knew, as most Black people did, that for more than 40 years, the government had Black men in Alabama participating in a syphilis study under the guise of getting free medical care when they weren't. And the mistreatment goes on today. Black women are 2 to 3 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes than white women. Many Black women say that when they express their health concerns to providers, they're either ignored or outright dismissed.
Trust should be earned. Trust should be demonstrated through actions that are trustworthy. Through those centuries of medical exploitation and experimentation, we have had some changes in clinical research. We now have informed consent in place. That process of making sure that any person who participates in clinical research, whether it's a vaccine trial or, you know, investigation of a particular drug, knows the benefits and knows the risks.
Volunteering for the clinical trial was Dr. Purnell's way to be accountable, but she also had a much more personal reason.
I know how important it is in solutioning around this pandemic, which has been so destructive. It has been so destructive for Black and brown communities, and it has been destructive in my family personally. I lost my dad, so I am the disproportionate burden that coronavirus has impacted the Black and brown community. That is me. That's my family. The week that we did the virtual services for my father is almost to the day is when my sister discovered that she too had coronavirus. So that is unusual. And I use my story as a way to explain the human cost and the human toll for others to really grapple with.
Purnell's father was a self-taught scientist who went from cutting grass at Bell Labs in New Jersey to becoming a member of the technical staff, a position usually reserved for PhD scientists.
My dad would frequently say to me, follow the data, follow the science. And as a public health physician, I believe in public health science. So this was personal for me. It's a part of me living out my father's legacy, is a part of me helping to, you know, be in covenant with community, and is a part of me adding to the public health science, adding to the data to help us find a solution.
Dr. Purnell offering herself up for a clinical trial doesn't surprise Catherine Benjamin Golden, a professor of Africana Studies at the University of Delaware. She says Black women have always been leaders in the fight against oppression and in support of the community.
When we want to talk about a history of Black women stepping up and stepping into these moments of crises around public health and a traditional understanding of what public health is, was the 1793 yellow fever pandemic, because Black women were noted in this as being the real saviors of this moment.
In 1793, yellow fever hit Philadelphia hard. The disease that was transmitted to humans by infected mosquitoes killed nearly 5,000 people, about 10% of the city's population.
People were experiencing fever and people were experiencing muscle pain and black vomiting, which is really caused from internal bleeding and jaundice. So this was really scary. This was a moment of panic and people didn't know what was causing it.
Anyone who could afford to get out of the city left, including George Washington and Alexander Hamilton. Free and enslaved black women became caregivers, tending to those suffering from the terrifying illness.
The gravity of that labor. Women that were elderly Black women were working as nurses. Young Black women were working as nurses. Many were getting the fever themselves. They were up all night. They were up all day without anyone to relieve them. They were worn down with fatigue and want of sleep. They didn't have colleagues to step in and relieve them when their shift was over. Their shift was ongoing. So these are the essential workers of 1793, and they're largely Black women and men, and largely Black women doing this nursing work, and Black men sort of coming in more to do the interment of dead bodies.
Dr. Benjamin Golden sees a through line between the work of women during the 1793 pandemic and today, especially in the minimum wage workers who, only since the emergence of the pandemic, are being recognized as essential workers.
I think more than one in three Black women are on the front lines as essential workers in some sense. So doing grocery work or food service work, delivery service, hospital workers, first responders, these are largely people of color and largely women. And so from this history of 1793, I think we're really understanding, you know, just how disposable these workers have been across time, have been treated and regarded across time. You know, they weren't paid a livable wage. They're still doing this work. They're charged with forms of labor really that are keeping society afloat. Back in 1793 and in 2020, we are among the most vulnerable because of the ways in which we have to, or Black women have historically had to take these roles to support their families, support their communities, and really also just keep society running.
Once the pandemic is under control, Black women will still be on the front lines, battling an insidious disease that so far has no cure.
I'm making that comparison between public health crises that affect our bodies and this holistic experience of anti-Black racism and what that feels like, and how this is the first fight that Black women engage in and try to remedy and attack.
That's how it's always been for Black women, fighting threats to health like the pandemic and gun violence alongside racism that's ongoing.
That's the connection I'm trying to make, I think, between the earlier histories of Black women
being the leaders and being right there on the front lines, doing this community work of care and community work of nurture out of a sense of duty and community responsibility, but also as out of a sense of their own survival and care for themselves and their families. And that idea that no one else is going to. And so I'm going to continue to work in these ways that may place me in vulnerable positions. And, you know, my life has to be thought of after a greater good. And I think that that is a tradition that Black women bring and Black women have lived. It certainly inspires me. It certainly inspires the work that I do.
Volunteers of the Black Doctors COVID-19 Consortium say they don't see their organization ending anytime soon. Dr. Gonzalez says Ayla Stanford's vision has created a movement, and now the BDCC has become something bigger than themselves.
I can foresee this becoming a permanent thing because even hopefully long after the pandemic is gone, now that there's this exposure of this health disparity, I could foresee the BDCC transitioning into this entity that now is a place where people of the Black community can seek medical care and feel that they're being cared for by a trusted physician and someone they relate to, and that they're going to get the care that they need.
What they know for sure is that the community appreciates them.
We're standing on the shoulders of people who believe in us. People have put more money in my hand as donation to the BDCC than I think I have ever seen. Take this. I want to donate. And we had repeat customers. I had a guy, I tested him 3 different times, and I vaccinated him for both of his shots.
During a recent Vaxathon at the Leocora Center, when BDCC vaccines hit 25,000, Dr. Stanford decided to mark the occasion. She paused operations, shut down a lane of Broad Street between Montgomery and Cecil B. Moore Avenues, enlisted an ambulance parked outside to pump dance music through its speakers, and she and her volunteers broke out into a line dance right there in the middle of the street.
It was the most moving and fun thing I think I have ever done.
And part of the joy that comes with sharing the same culture is that you know how to celebrate.
It was just hype. It was just a really fun, super, Black experience. And then in that part of Philly where we were just, we are taking over Philly for 3 seconds.
It's that kind of leadership and willingness to work for the health of the Black community that inspires us all. Real Black History was produced by Jeanette Woods. We had editing help from Katie Colinari, Melanie Roy, and Sabrina Boyd Circa. Mike Villers was our engineer. Archival audio was provided by the Reverend Marshall Mitchell of Salem Baptist Church in Abington, Pennsylvania. Sandra Clark is Vice President for News and Civic Dialogue. I'm Annette John Hall. Thanks for listening.